go ahead and get started. So you can see the word cloud here. So on behalf of Dr. Miguel Escobar and Dr. Angela Wyan, I'm happy to be chairing this session, Prophylaxis in Patients with von Willebrand Disease, Expert Perspectives and Shared Experiences. This is Medicom Worldwide Incorporated, and it's supported by an educational grant from Takeda Pharmaceuticals in the United States. So I'll leave these faculty disclosures for everybody to peruse. So these are the learning objectives to outline recent guidelines regarding the use of short and long-term prophylaxis, identify patient and disease characteristics that suggest the patient with VWD will benefit from that long-term prophylaxis, summarize the safety and efficacy data from recent and ongoing trials, outline factors that must be considered when identifying therapeutic strategies, doses, and regimens for prophylaxis in patients or persons with von Willebrand disease. So we're gonna cover a lot in the next hour. So I'm gonna start this out, and we're gonna talk about the current standard of care in von Willebrand disease and how we can meet those challenges. It's really exciting actually to see a number of clinical trials with actually available data. Hopefully even more data will be seen at ASH meeting as well. So I'm Robert Sidonio, as mentioned before. I'm at Emory University at Children's Healthcare Atlanta. This is a great picture. It's not why I have a mustache, but it's a great mustache that he has. This is Eric von Willebrand disease, von Willebrand, and he reported mucocutaneous bleeding and unfortunately death among several families that were living on the Åland Islands in the Baltic Sea, and I've circled it for you in case you knew where that was already. The characteristics were pretty straightforward. They're both males and females, so looked different than hemophilia. The bleeding time, which I believe they used on the ear at the time, was quite prolonged. I can't imagine doing those bleeding times and watch it not stop bleeding for 15 to 20 minutes. In the index case was a 5-year-old girl named Hjordis. I always want to tell the story in the clinic, in our menstrual bleeding clinic, but then I remembered that she died after her fourth menstrual period, which is probably not an appropriate story to tell teenage girls that are just coming to our clinic for the first time. Not only did she have heavy menstrual bleeding, she had very prolonged issues with musculoskeletal bleeding, and they didn't have any treatment, so she pretty much had to rest and lay down for multiple weeks. We know that at least 25,000 cases of von Willebrand disease are there, and many are unrecognized, and likely the prevalence is somewhere in the 1 in 1,000 range. So just for level setting, but everybody probably knows because there's been actually a number of von Willebrand talks, there are two important roles, and there likely are many other roles that we don't know. We know that von Willebrand's factor tethers the platelet to the exposed collagen, as seen in this cartoon, in this paper done by Dr. Paula James. And then it serves as a carrier protein for factor VIII, delivering it to the site of damage and allowing for hemostasis. We know the genetics has actually been fairly well described, but if you were at a talk yesterday by Dr. Jill Johnson, there's probably more work that we need to be done in this field, focusing on genotyping, focusing on structural variants. Thankfully, most of it's has been mapped out, and I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be elucidating more of this. But it's been a lot of work that's been done by a number of experts, including one of them sitting there, Dr. Montgomery. The classification, these are even the ones listed here on the subtypes, they're not all of them. They're going to be more coming, and they're not just doing it just to make it really difficult in your life. It is important, I think, to discern between the different subtypes. I think we all know there are certain types of 2A that bleed quite a lot, and it's nice to be able to predict that for the family and make sure they understand what the bleeding they have. But generally, type 1 is where there is an issue with secretion or clearance. They have below normal levels of VWF, and it can be as mildly deficient as 40 to 50% as you would see in low VWF, or could be as severe as you see, almost as severe as in type 3. I think that's what makes it very difficult, because most of our healthcare providers see mild type 1 and they associate von Willebrand's with that. That makes up most of the cases. I think these numbers will change as we genotype more patients. I think they're likely more type 2 patients. Type 2 patients may or may not have reduced levels of VWF, but the VWF fails to work properly. And they can have some severity that can be quite severe, so it says mild to moderate, but many type 2A patients have pretty severe disease. And type 3 is one of those ones that's really easy to diagnose. You have absolutely no VWF, and you have an associated factor VIII level that is quite low. and can often be confused with hemophilia. I think this is gonna be really interesting. I was part of a case in which a child had excessive bleeding at birth. They actually did whole exome sequencing, and ultimately this child was determined to have type 2N / type 1 von Willebrand disease with absolutely no functional testing done for at least a year or two after the diagnosis. I think we're gonna see a lot more of those kind of cases in which the genotype is gonna be described even before the functional testing. There are many subtypes, I'm not gonna go through all of them, but it's important to separate them out, and there's a whole set of guidelines you can utilize to make that diagnosis. One of the things I really wanted to sort of emphasize, and hopefully you've heard that from here at this meeting, is hemophilia is not von Willebrand's, and some of the comments that Dr. Wyan was talking about trying to apply the same metrics for one disorder for the other, like, you know, we have to run the trial just like we run the hemophilia trials. Well, we shouldn't have to do that. ABRs are, I don't think a hemophilia ABR is anywhere near the same thing as a von Willebrand ABR. And I don't want to minimize the ABR in von Willebrand's, but it is quite different. We know that in von Willebrand's, the majority of bleeding is typically mucocutaneous. With worse severity, it can become more musculoskeletal. A majority have mild deficiency, I think, which colors our opinion of what von Willebrand has. And at least half the cases are incompletely penetrant. Makes diagnosis quite challenging, and hopefully our genotyping efforts are going to improve that. The hemophilia, although there's not perfect correlation, there tends to be fairly consistent inheritance. The majority of the patients have moderate to severe disease, so that really colors our opinion as well of what hemophilia is compared to von Willebrand's. And I think, you know, we've done a really good job of taking care of hemophilia patients. We have all these wonderful drugs. I think the time for von Willebrand's is now, and I think we need the next decade, we need to catch up to hemophilia care and really advocate for this patient population. So I think all of these issues and trying to sort of attribute and trying to say, you know, we can do everything just like we did in hemophilia that worked for our hemophilia trials. I think part of the problem is there's been quite a variety in management. I think we see this, we get these referrals where patients are not adequately managed. They're not offered things like prophylaxis when it could be something offered. I was revising a chapter on von Willebrand's, and there's a whole section about how prophylaxis in von Willebrand's rare should be rarely offered and should be only considered in very extreme situations. Of course, I deleted that section when I changed it. But a lot of this leads to discrepancy in care. By the time the patient comes to you, they're extremely frustrated. And that can make it difficult because you're the first person getting this. The nurses are hearing this, and so you're spending a lot of time de-escalating and trying to ensure them that you're not going to be the same. There have been very few trials in von Willebrand's. When we talk about trials, we get super excited when we have 20 to 30 patients in this trial. And it's likely because of the design of these trials, and oftentimes they don't allow us in these von Willebrand trials to have what we call PTPs. Those are widely accepted in hemophilia to have PTP trials, but they're not as widely accepted in von Willebrand's because they want to show the difference, which may be difficult to show a significant improvement. We know that back in 2006, just as a reminder, technically there was insufficient evidence from RCTs to determine whether prophylactic clotting factor concentrates would decrease bleeding and bleeding-related complications in hemophilia A or B. It wasn't much longer after that in which those trials were conducted, and that changed that opinion. But we know that there were many countries prior to 2006, particularly in Europe, that were implementing prophylaxis in hemophilia. So I know that RCTs are the gold standard, but we don't need to wait for them to do these kind of things. And obviously, we need to advocate for our patients. We're not going to wait 5 to 6 years until an RCT comes out and demonstrates that prophylaxis has a role. As mentioned before in other talks, there's been international effort to develop guidelines. There are a number of people in this room that were integral in this. It had two different papers that came out, one led by Paula James, one led by Nathan Connell. These were pretty rigorous. This took multiple years to develop, and it's probably going to be, I don't know, it's been 10 years before we do another one of these. These are expensive endeavors. Obviously, we put a lot of time and effort in this, and we had patient inclusion, which actually colored a lot of our decision-making is how the patients felt about how we were going to vote on certain topics. I think the definition of hemophilia has been sort of illustrated. It's been slowly refined. primary prophylaxis before the second bleed or before a large evident joint bleed. And certainly we've defined secondary and tertiary when we come to hemophilia. It hasn't been perfectly described. Nathan Connell attempted to come up with a consensus of what prophylaxis should be at a period of at least 3 to 6 months of treatment, consisting of VWF concentrate administered at least once weekly, and for women with heavy menstrual bleeding, use of concentrate administered at least once per menstrual cycle. So we attempted to come up with some definition, and it's not going to be the same as hemophilia, and it doesn't need to be the same as hemophilia. So I think we don't need to measure everything through the lens of hemophilia just because that's what we know. But one of the recommendations that was really integral in this was really probably the most important thing that came out of the management part was recommendation one here. In patients with von Willebrand's and a history of severe and frequent bleeds, the guideline panel suggests long-term prophy rather than no prophylaxis. There's a caveat there. Obviously, this is a conditional recommendation based on the low certainty of evidence, but it's clear based on expert opinion, and it's likely to be strengthened by future research, and it was deemed as the majority would want this course of action. And so I think it's really important to notice that the severity of von Willebrand's is not listed, and the subtype isn't specifically listed there as well. So it's really focusing on the bleeding symptoms and the outcomes of achieving hemostatic control and limiting anemia. There are a number of concentrates that are available. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I know Dr. Escobar and Dr. Wyan are going to go more into this. It's really important mainly just to show this chart is that they have different ratios, they have different half-lives, and certainly now they have different indications, and we're hopeful that in the next few years a couple of these products will have expansion of their labels because I think that's really important. You know, we don't, oftentimes we see that it's not indicated for prophylaxis. And I know that, I haven't been practicing that long, but there have been a number of us in this room that prescribed factor for prophylaxis for hemophilia before there was a label as well. So I don't think we always need to wait on that. Hopefully everybody will advocate and consider participation in these trials because it's really important for this patient population. When you look at prophy and von Willebrand's, I'm going to go through quickly on this. The von Willebrand Prophy Network was set up almost a decade ago, and they were able to demonstrate, this is part of the dose escalation prospective study, but after they did a retrospective study, you can see the levels there. You had to have less than 20% for type 1, and you had to have a diagnosis by your local provider. But you can see clearly here, prior to prophylaxis in the first the number of patients listed by symptoms, their the number of bleeds prior to that, during prophylaxis and the change, and you can see a lot of negative numbers, meaning there was an improvement in bleeding. One of the things that probably wasn't as improved was GI bleeding, and we all know that that's a difficult measurement, and it certainly doesn't mean that we shouldn't use concentrate, but it's more complex than just replacing with concentrate. So last couple slides here, and I know I keep talking about, I don't want to talk about hemophilia, but then I keep talking about it. But translating the success of prophylaxis in hemophilia, I think there are some lessons we learned. This is a great paper by Wolfgang Miesbach, who talks about the differences there. You know, we have hemophilia. We've defined what prophylaxis is. We generally know what the doses are, and these are doses of, prior to some label changes here, of standard half-life products. And we know generally what we should be doing for on-demand doses. And for von Willebrand disease, and this is going to change because this paper was in 2021, we're still trying to define it. He attempted to define it with this date of over 45 weeks per year. And so I think, you know, we're still all trying to nail down what's the exact definition of von Willebrand prophylaxis. And likely there is tailored dosing based on the bleeding symptom. At least that's my belief, is that prophy dosing should be based on what kind of bleeding symptom occurs, and likely that's going to be how we conduct trials in the future when we talk about von Willebrand disease. There are a number of benefits and barriers. Obviously, lots of benefits of prophylaxis, higher activity levels, physical activity, a greater participation, less school and work missed, better quality of life, hopefully reduction of hemarthropathy that we may see in the future. there are a lot of barriers. You know, a lot of providers, even at this meeting, don't see the benefit of prophylaxis for their patients, certainly not for all your patients, but some of them. These are IV drugs. There's going to be some adherence issues, and there's going to be definitely some issues related to our patients to accepting it. We always talk about this. IV culture has been widely accepted in hemophilia. Everybody expects this. Patients always tell me they don't like needles. I said, I don't like needles. Nobody likes needles. So, but it's a culture that's accepted. You have all the women that know how to stick all the men in the family for hemophilia. And in families with von Willebrand's, most people don't have any venipuncture skills, and it hasn't been deemed as something that we should teach them, you know, and really try to, you know, implement those things that we taught about hemophilia in the early days of the HTC development. And I hope that there, you know, there's an unmet need there. Obviously, I believe there's personalized prophylaxis that should be considered. We all just give doses for von Willebrand factor, I think. We typically use the doses in the guidelines. Most of us probably don't look at incremental recovery. We don't check levels, and we don't do the calculations. And so I think we need to do better by our patients when it comes to that and try to do a better job of implementing what we've learned in hemophilia. And this is the last slide here. Cecile made a nice paper here about the future of von Willebrand's. You know, you can see all of the improvements there. It's a really short timeline for von Willebrand's. Starts with cryo, intermediate purity concentrates, desmopressin, single high purity concentrate. And the only thing that's changed in the last few decades is the advent of a single recombinant concentrate. And I often wonder, you know, we've advocated for our patients with von Willebrand's for hemophilia to be mostly on recombinant products, and we haven't applied that same metric into von Willebrand's. There are a number of things being investigated. Certain drugs that may have a benefit are listed here, including investigational drugs, monoclonal antibodies created by Benny Sorensen and HEMAB, and BT200 may have actually a role in this as well. So there is some excitement of new drugs, non-factor therapies that may actually be really beneficial for this patient population. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Angela Wyand, who hails from University of Michigan, who's a native of Kansas City that I learned last session. So Angela, I'll let you take it from there.
Thank you. I'm going to be speaking a little bit more about applying the guidelines. I was able to be a member of the ASH, ISTH, NHF, WFH guideline panel on the management of von Willebrand's disease, so we'll be talking a little bit about that recommendation number one. So this was when we kind of prioritized the topics that we wanted to discuss in the management guidelines. This was like kind of universally accepted as something that we should discuss. I think it is unfortunate that within hemophilia it is just accepted, like we put all of our severe patients on prophylaxis. More and more that's becoming moderate patients as well. And this, I think, even in people who do von Willebrand's disease a lot, is not our way of approaching it yet. I think even though I was on the guideline panel and we talked about this, I still find myself trying a lot of different other things before thinking about prophylaxis, which I think is unfortunate, and I'm hoping that will change over time. But the question that we wanted to cover was, in patients with von Willebrand's disease with a history of severe and frequent bleeds, should routine prophylaxis or no routine prophylaxis be used? And I think Robert mentioned this is, you know, vague, like severe and frequent. This is obviously going to be left to the discretion of the treating physician and the patient together. But we did, you know, after looking at all of the data out there, decide a conditional recommendation with low certainty that we would recommend use of prophylaxis. I was surprised, I think, when we were reviewing all of the evidence. These guideline panels are pretty intense, and you have specific person on the guideline panel that's all they do is help people with guidelines. And so they're very adept at assessing the evidence and going through it and assessing it for bias and telling you what is wrong with every single study that's ever been done. There's a lot wrong with every single study that's ever been done, especially with von Willebrand's disease, unfortunately. It's what they told us. But basically, the evidence that we reviewed to come to this recommendation was one randomized controlled trial comparing prophylaxis to placebo, five pre and post analyses that had an explicit comparison between the time periods, and then eight pre and post analyses that had an implicit comparison between the time periods. And basically what that body of evidence showed was that the use of routine VWF concentrate prophylaxis reduced the risk of bleeding, reduced epistaxis, improved or increased the time to first bleeding event, and also reduced the risk of bleeding episodes, hospitalizations, and heavy menstrual bleeding. When we were assessing all of the evidence, we did find that in the randomized control trial, there was a question of possibly increased bleeding episodes lasting longer than 2 days, as well as increased gastrointestinal hemorrhage. But as Robert mentioned, all of these trials are pretty low enrollment overall. There are not a lot of patients involved. And so the majority of the gastrointestinal bleeding and the episodes that lasted over 2 days were within one patient who happened to be in the prophylaxis arm, which likely led to some overestimation of the harm there. So the panels are composed of physicians, and they try to make them very multidisciplinary and include patients. And a lot of coming to the guideline recommendation is putting a lot of thought into like how this is going to increase equity and how this is going to help patients get the very best care that they can get. And so a lot of the discussion around coming to the recommendation for prophylaxis was that patients really place a very high value on reducing the risk of bleeding, especially if that bleeding is causing impairments in their overall quality of life. But clearly the value, because there are the barriers of intravenous infusion and having to do that, that the value depends on the frequency and the severity of the bleeding, that this should really be a shared decision-making process between the healthcare provider and the patient, and that there is likely to be pretty significant variability in the values of the specific patients. And really, we also wanted to make sure there was a lot of educational materials available, both for the patients as well as the healthcare providers that are treating these patients. Since the publication of the guidelines, so as Robert mentioned, it was a multi-year process, and so at some point, they have to cut off the literature that they're going to consider for the guidelines, even if like a brand new study comes out in the middle of that process. So since the guidelines were published, there's been a little bit of more evidence coming out for prophylaxis. This was a phase 3 open label study in adults. It was not randomized, but estimated, did use a similar ABR to what is used in hemophilia. There were two patient groups. One were patients that had previously just been on in-demand therapy, and another were patients that had been on a plasma-derived VWF product. This study was looking at the recombinant product, and so patients who had previously been on on-demand were started on twice weekly recombinant VWF at a dose of 50 international units per kilo. The patients who were switching from plasma-derived, their dose was actually based on their prior dose because they wanted to be able to compare the two and ranged anywhere from 1 to 3 times weekly with a maximum dose of 80 international units per kilo. You can see on the left the demographics of the patients. As you would expect, a majority of the patients had type 3 disease. There was a pretty equivalent mix of males and females, although there was a predominance of males in the switch group and a predominance of females in the prior on-demand group. The historical spontaneous annualized bleed rate was pretty high at 6.5, not too bad in the group that had previously been on plasma-derived at 0.51, and both of those actually improved. I think no surprise at all that the ABR decreased when you went from on-demand to prophylaxis, but there was also a 45% decrease when they went from the plasma drive to the recombinant product. Overall, the recombinant VWF factor product was considered to be safe. There was only one adverse event that actually led to discontinuation of the product. That was a non-serious headache that occurred with the infusion, and so they decided to stop the product. There were some serious adverse events like falls and I think a dental problem that clearly weren't related to the product. This is another study that actually looked at patients that were receiving long-term prophylaxis with Vonsinto, and as you can see, it's pretty small, but there were a very number of reasons that patients were started on prophylaxis, ranging from joint bleeding, recurrent hematomas, ENT bleeding. Again, in this study, there were the majority of patients were type 3 disease, and there was a pretty good distribution between male and female patients. I was impressed with the age range of 1 to 85 included, so pretty much all ages of our patients. And this basically just looked at kind of the doses that patients were on. Roughly, patients were typically on 2 infusions per week and had a pretty low ABR of 0.5. They also did compare patients who'd previously been on another prophylaxis treatment and their ABRs did improve when they switched to Voncento. There were, I think, 4 patients that previously had not been on prophylaxis, so they weren't included in that analysis. So I think, you know, there is a rationale for long-term prophylaxis in a number of our von Willebrand's patients. I think type 3 patients, especially type 3 patients that are having severe and recurrent bleeding, patients with joint bleeding, I think there's definitely, more reason to start them. And I think gastrointestinal bleeding is just so difficult to manage. And we know with the angiodysplasia that occurs, really a pretty long course of prophylaxis is needed to help heal all of that up. I think heavy menstrual bleeding too, you know, I see a lot of patients with heavy menstrual bleeding, and I think a lot of us, like, knee-jerk response is hormones or antifibrinolytics, but I think that a lot of these patients would clearly benefit from factor products. I think it does just become that hurdle of, getting people comfortable with IV administration and you know, having them accept that. But I think at least with heavy menstrual bleeding, it isn't a super frequent infusion. And with that, I will hand it over to Dr. Escobar.
All right, thank you. So in this next 15 or so minutes, what I'd like to do is talk about some of the therapeutic strategies in von Willebrand disease, and also touch some about, the use of these therapeutic strategies in surgery as well. So, you know, when we treat patients with von Willebrand, you know, we're going to either treat them on demand for the acute bleeds, we're going to treat them, when they go to surgery to prevent the bleeding, or we can certainly do prophylaxis that has been already mentioned. But the goal is going to be the same, right? It's going to, what we're going to try here is to prevent or control the bleeding, improving the platelet adhesion aggregation, and at the end forming a stable clot, right, a fibrin clot. And we can do it in different ways. We can use replacement therapy, and the goal here is, to increase the plasma concentration of what is missing, the von Willebrand, using either a plasma-derived product or now using a recombinant von Willebrand factor. We can use non-replacement therapy, and, it has kind of the same goal, which is increase the plasma concentration of von Willebrand by stimulating the release of endogenous stores of von Willebrand. An example is desmopressin. And we can use adjunctive therapy as well. This is used, certain agents, antifibrinolytics, to promote hemostasis and also help with the wound healing. Now, when we treat patients, we can do a combination of these, depending on the type of bleed, depending on the age, and certainly if some patients are going to surgery, we can also definitely have a combination of different products. Now, the important thing, and I think Robert already alluded about this, is that, not all the replacement products are the same. Right, they have different ratios, as you already have seen, in terms of factor VIII to ristocine or von Willebrand, so they should not be really considered interchangeable. Now, it's important to be able to monitor these patients. If you're going to do a single treatment, it's probably not necessary, but in patients that are going to be, let's say, in prophylaxis, like similar to do with hemophilia, or definitely patients that are going on undergoing major surgeries, it would be probably important to be able to maintain certain levels and be able, to check those levels. We just don't want to make sure we don't have excess amount of von Willebrand or factor VIII. So we need to definitely assess the thrombotic risk, and if necessary, we need to, do some preventive strategies for these patients. Now, specifically about desmopressin, you're already familiar with the mechanism of action. Now, in terms of the recommendations for its use, is mostly for type 1 von Willebrand. In those patients that have what we call low von Willebrand levels, let's say between 30 and 50, we assume that adults are probably going to be responsive to this strategy. But, recommendation is in children, if needed, then you could do a trial of DDAVP. Now, for those individuals that have von Willebrand levels below 30, the panel suggests performing a desmopressin trial and treating based on those results. Some of the patients are not going to have probably an increase compared to other individuals. So for those type 1, the type 1 Cs most likely are not going to be responders, but it could be used at the first line for those patients that have type 1, they're, on demand, or if it's a minor surgery, certainly something like desmopressin could be used. For the 2As, 2M, and 2Ns, it could have a partial response in this individual or a short-lived response. And again, it could be useful sometimes for minor bleeding or minor procedures. For the 2Bs, we usually do not use it. It could worsen the, if patients already have thrombocytopenia, and definitely the type 3s, they're not going to respond. Robert already showed this slide, and again, is to emphasize one thing is they have different ratios between factor VIII and von Willebrand, so again, they should not be interchangeable. They have different half-lives. It can go anywhere from 7.5 hours all the way to 19 hours. And as you can see here, they have been approved for, they have different indications. You know, they might not make a difference for you in the clinic, but maybe for the payers, it might make a difference in regards to if it gets approved or not. Most of these products are approved for treatment on demand and surgery. And as already mentioned, we have one product of recombinant von Willebrand that recently was approved for the use of prophylaxis in severe von Willebrand disease. Now, in terms of the factor concentrate target labels, I think this has always been an issue of discussion. I think it's also very different from hemophilia. And the recommendation is, you know, somebody that has a bleeding episode, you're going to treat on demand, let's say a mild to moderate bleed. Recommendation is to have peak levels maybe above 50% or so on day one, and then maybe having trough levels around 30 or so after day one. And the length of treatment is going to depend, again, on the type of bleed. It can be anywhere from 1 to 3 days if it's something minor. Now, for those patients that have a severe bleed, recommendation is to have a peak above 100 at least on day one, and then having trough levels of above 50, after day one or so. And again, the length of treatment is going to depend on the type of bleeding. Patients that undergo surgical procedures for uncomplicated procedures, let's say a minor surgery, you can have a single dose, have a peak greater than 50 for one day, and that's usually enough. Now, for something that is probably a little more than a simple procedure, peaks of probably about 50 to 80 on day one, and then trough levels about 30 for the next day or two. Length of treatment, again, anywhere between 1 to 5 days. For the major surgeries, the recommendation is to have a peak above 100 on day one, and then having trough levels above 50 after day one. And again, treatment on length, it's going to depend on the type of surgery. Now, it's important, to be able to monitor this patient, especially the patients that undergo major surgeries are going to be treated for many days. Ideal is not to exceed von Willebrand levels above 200, or factor VIII levels probably about 250 to 300 for prolonged periods of time. And that's why it's important the monitoring of these patients. Then we need to assess the thrombotic risk, and if necessary, then we need to, take preventive strategies for these individuals. Some of the studies are already mentioned. Angela mentioned the study that was done by Ruggeri. This is another study that came from the Europeans. This was a phase 3 study that compared secondary prophylaxis to on-demand. This was a randomized open-label study, but they looked at individuals to see if they can prevent spontaneous bleeding in patients that had severe von Willebrand, but there were unresponsive to DDABP. When they compared to the on-demand group, and we see that the majority of those individuals, as expected, had mostly mucocutaneous type bleeding. And you had the two groups, the on-demand and the prophylaxis. What they found in this study is, that the prophylactic use of this specific product appeared to be associated with a lower risk and frequency of bleeding episodes in patients with severe von Willebrand that were unresponsive to DDAVP. Now, they mentioned here that there was probably not a lot of data on GI bleeding, and I think this is a circumstance which is quite unique for certain patients with von Willebrand. And it's possible that we might need clinical trials just for patients that have GI bleeding, especially the type 3s. Those individuals really have a very unique type of GI bleeding that we don't even see those in patients with hemophilia. And those could be quite complex individuals to manage. Now, this is a very busy slide, but I just want you to concentrate on the right-hand side. And here you can see the outcome of the studies that have been reported doing prophylaxis in von Willebrand disease. And you see that it's actually quite effective. So do we really need more studies to show that prophylaxis is effective in certain patients with von Willebrand? Probably not, from a clinician perspective. Maybe in the pediatric group, we might need some of those studies, or maybe more for the regulatory agencies, most likely we're going to need, studies so they can approve certain products. But I think it shows very well, although, the data might not be as robust as Robert mentioned in hemophilia, but I think there's enough evidence that definitely these patients benefit from the use of prophylaxis. Now, going back to the study that Angela mentioned, the phase 3 trial using prophylaxis with a recombinant von Willebrand factor, Vonicoc alpha, in patients with severe disease. This study, again, investigated the efficacy and the safety of prophylaxis in adults. And they, what they did was they looked at a historical, and then they put those patients on prophylaxis. They had two arms, the prior on-demand, and the patients that were already on prophylaxis with a plasma derived product and got switched then to the recombinant. But we see here that in terms of the spontaneous ABR, there was a decrease from 6.54 down to 0.56, meaning a 91% reduction, which is expected in somebody coming from on-demand treatment. And then in the switch arm, again, with those individuals that were in prophylaxis with a plasma right, and got switched to the recombinant, we see there is a decrease from 0.51 to 0.28 with a 45% reduction. This was not significant, but those patients maintained their hemostasis. Now, in terms of the secondary efficacy analysis, looking at the spontaneous ABR intrapatient comparison, in those individuals looking at reduction success, more than 25% for all types of von Willebrand, it was 92%, and for the type 3 specifically, was 90%. And when we look at the spontaneous ABR preservation success, meaning those patients that were prior prophylaxis and got moved to the recombinant, we see that for all types of von Willebrand, 90%, and for the type 3s, it was 88%. So quite effective as well. Now, the secondary efficacy here treated spontaneous ABRs. Now, to the left, you have the prior on-demand group. You can see that at least 77% of those individuals had between 2 and 5 bleeds. They got switched to the prophylaxis arm, and you can see that 84.6% of those patients had 0 bleeds during the trial. To the right, we got the switch group. Those 60% of those individuals had less than 2 bleeds, compared to 60 and 70% had 0 bleeds. So very similar in terms of the comparison between the switch group and the recombinant von Willebrand. Now, just to briefly mention, there's another study, the Athens 9 study. This is looking at the natural history of severe von Willebrand disease. And this is a study that is ongoing. At least I think until the beginning of the year, they were already enrolled about 81 of a total of 130 individuals. And what they want to look at here is certainly seeing the safety of this individual, the treatment, how effective it is, and the different practices, treating patients with von Willebrand. And the doses are right now, they vary between 50 and 54 unit per kilo dose, an average of about 2 times per week, both for the plasma and the recombinant product. And you see here the treatment type, the distribution of the different treatment types. So I think it will be an interesting study to see the results of that. So if you have opportunity to enroll patients, we definitely encourage to do so. Now, in terms of, again, surgery management, briefly just to talk about tranexamic acid. The recommendations from the guidelines is for minor procedures. The panel suggests increasing von Willebrand activity levels greater than 50 with desmopressin or factor concentrate with the addition of tranexamic acid. The panel also suggests giving tranexamic acid alone or increasing von Willebrand activity levels greater than 50 for the type 1 with a baseline von Willebrand activity greater than 30. For a mild bleeding phenotype or for a minor mucosal procedure. Now, for those patients that have a high risk of thrombosis, avoid the combination of extended increased von Willebrand and factor VIII levels and extended use of tranexamic acid as well. Now, to finalize here, again, we have less data in regards to clinical trials in patients with von Willebrand disease undergoing surgery. There is a summary of 2 systematic reviews in the literature. But as you can see at the end, there's a lot of case series and very few randomized, really, clinical trials in surgery. So given the low-quality evidence for guidance management decisions, a shared decision really model is important here. And I think this is when it's very important to be able to have the comprehensive team and be able to make individualized decisions, for all our patients. So with this, I think we're going to discuss a couple of cases. So our first case is a 25-year-old female with histiomenorrhagia who has been managed by a primary doctor and an OBGYN for the last 10 years. She took oral contraceptives for a few years, but stopped due to severe acne and headaches. She was told she could have on Villaban, and her mother had a history of menorrhagia as well. Now, her personal history is of heavy menstrual bleeding associated with flooding periods longer than 7 days, iron deficiency anemia, history of easy bruising. She had no dental procedures, but she had an appendectomy at age 22 with laparoscopic, and apparently there was no bleeding complications. And you can see to the right the results of her study. She had an antigen of 37, a risdocin of 32, and a factor 8 of 70%, and the pictorial chart was pretty high as well. So, you know, I think this is something that we typically see in our clinics. So the issue here becomes, you know, what is the best treatment option or treatment options to manage this young lady? So what are the treatment options for the management of this young lady that have heavy menstrual bleeding? I think this is a very typical case, right, Robert or Angela, what you see in your clinics. I mean, what is your approach? Let's say you got a brand new patient coming in like that. Do you have maybe some sort of algorithm or some sort of approach that you undergo with somebody, you know, coming brand new to your clinic?
Yeah, I can start it out. So the typically, you know, the patients may have had a negative experience on whatever product they have, and it could have been just the right product in the wrong hands and not the right treatment strategy. So, you know, so we always say there are lots of different, you know, birth control options, controlled COCs. Just because that one didn't work or it didn't work the right way, maybe it wasn't implemented the correct way. Certainly, you have to take in things like migraine headache, history of thrombosis, things like that as well. And then, you know, whether there's any history of concern for depression or anxiety when you're considering these hormonal therapies as well. You know, we obviously have to have a discussion. This is a 22-year-old, so you don't have to bring in the parents' decisions on here. But really asking questions about what are you seeking? Are you sexually active? And typically at that age, they are. And so that may help guide you down one path of products that may also control heavy menstrual bleeding as well as offer birth control. And they may have some, you know, there are patients that come in clearly that have no desire to be on any hormonal option or have had lots of different side effects from it. And so we talk about things like tranexamic acid or non-birth control options. And we typically start with the least invasive. And I know my OBGYN colleagues often will offer IUDs up front. In younger clinics, we don't do that. Of course, a 22-year-old, that's something you could offer up front as well.
So, Angela, what is your perspective?
Yeah, I agree with everything Robert said. I think when we were making the guideline, there was a guideline recommendation on the treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding, and I think one of the big kind of forks in the road is whether they want to conceive, right? Because they may be sexually active but wanting to conceive, and in that case, a hormonal therapy is not going to be appropriate for them. But, you know, that is a big part of the conversation, and I think a lot of it has to do with their bleeding pattern and also their own values and preferences. So with bleeding pattern, I see mostly pediatric adolescent patients, and so I find that if you have really prolonged bleeding, like girls that bleed for the majority of the month, tranexamic acid isn't great because it doesn't actually decrease your number of days of bleeding, right? It kind of decreases the amount of flow you're having, but it's still super disruptive to be bleeding for most days of the month versus, you know, having a patient who maybe bleeds for 5 days, it's just very heavy during that time. Taking tranexamic acid 3 times a day is doable, although again, it's 3 times a day, but some people would prefer to have that take 3 times a day, but only while I'm bleeding versus like, you know, a hormone of taking once a day or whatnot. And I think in a lot of ways, we tend to think of these things as like most invasive or least invasive, but I think I try to kind of flip that in my head because I think like with the IUD, you can say that's invasive, but it's actually like you put it in and then you're done, right? You don't have to take a pill every single day. Or like, you know, VWF concentrate, like you come in, yes, you have to get an IV or you do an IV at home, but it's like, you know, 1 or 2 doses and then you're done versus, you know, in some ways like intranasal DAVP, which is, you know, has a lot of side effects people often don't like. And I think weighing all of those things together, and it's not always as clear like what the most invasive or the most work or the most burden of treatment is going
to
be.
And then we have to ask the additional questions about pain, other side effects, and sort of consequences of that period as well, because some of the patients feel very strongly about having a period once a month, and that's their personal belief, and you know, and that's their preference. And so if that's something they desire, obviously
that helps guide us on the treatment. 100% agree with the tranexamic acid. I won't use it if it's chaotic menstrual bleeding throughout the month. It's just you can't be on TA all month long.
Now, in this specific, will you guys offer DDAVP up front in somebody like this?
Yeah, well, yeah, with that, with the limited availability of a stimate right now, that's kind of made it difficult. I found that it's very difficult because oftentimes, you know, with periods, they're associated with headaches, water retention. So that medicine can definitely need not something that a lot of women don't desire.
It was interesting. We talked about intranasal DDAVP for this question when we were doing the guidelines, and there's not like a great study that shows, you know, that one is definitively better than the other, but really the patient representatives on the panel were very opposed to DDAVP and talked about, you know, in all the groups, everyone hates DDAVP. They've never felt so bad as when they take it. And it was enlightening for me because when Stimate was available, we prescribe it a lot. And I think, you know, I wasn't always hearing that from patients, but definitely on the panel, it was very much like, no, even if it worked better than everything else, it's not worth it.
I mean, my impression is that I think we're using it less and less, not because it's not available, but even before that, I thought we were probably using it much less, especially in specific in this type of patients.
And I think if you do decide to use it, if there's somebody that has a good response to it, you know, giving it at night can be helpful because then the fluid restriction is easy because they're sleeping. And if they have a headache, hopefully it's happening while they're asleep as well or nauseated as well. So we've done that strategy. It's a tough long-term strategy to say you're going to do this for 12 months, and you know, but we have done that in some patients, you know, typically doing it on the first and maybe third or fourth day to avoid the tachyphylaxis that can sometimes occur with it.
Yeah. Now, do you guys usually do a trial on this, ladies?
For response, yeah, I think, you know, there's pretty good data from Michelle Lavin and the Irish group that the adult patients overwhelmingly respond that if they have levels of 30 to 50%. It's not really clear in children whether they have that overwhelming response. I know we looked at some of this data in the Zimmerman project, and it wasn't as well. The response rate was nowhere near as high. So I would advocate to do it. I think the levels were in the 20s, right? So I think definitely would advocate for a trial. Right.
So as Angela, you know, discussed here, the use of the panel suggested use either hormonal therapy or tranexamic acid over desmopressin to treat women with bleeding. Heavy menstrual bleeding and Willebrand disease that do not want to conceive. And the panel also suggested use of tranexamic acid over desmopressin to treat women with Willebrand and heavy menstrual bleeding who wish to conceive as well. And we discussed already, you know, the issue about role of prophylaxis. I mean, I guess once in some of those treatment fail, as we all do in our clinic, we have many patients now that have been on prophylaxis, especially during those maybe first few days of their periods. All right, let's go to our second and last case. This is also a young lady, 35-year-old, history of von Willebrand type 1. She played competitive sports in high school and college, basketball, volleyball, softball, with multiple injuries to her knees. She underwent 3 knee laparoscopic surgeries, covered with von Willebrand concentrate without any complications. And now she is not doing as many sports because she, I mean, her quality of life really have been affected now with that right knee. Having a lot of pain, she has been evaluated by orthopedics, and they do recommend to do a total knee replacement of the lady, even though she's so young, but she's got a lot of damage in that joint. So she works as an EMT. Her sister and her father have von Willebrand. Her history is of heavy menstrual bleeding with, you know, periods longer than 7 days, history of iron deficiency, bruising, and she does respond to the concentrate and tranexamic acid. And to the right, we have her results. Antigen of 19, resto of 18, and a factor rate of 68 with normal multimer. So this, again, is a major surgery. You know, what are the treatment options for this patient undergoing surgery? So if you want to reply again on the website, the question, you know, what is your experience in this type of surgeries, you know, like in your institutions?
So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, in the United States, that's true with the concentrate and antifibrinolytic. If you did the same poll in Europe, you'd find they would mix in DDAVP. You see this pretty frequently, and we all sort of get alarmed by it, like, how can you do that? That seems impossible, particularly with the fluid restriction issues for some long-term surgery. I think the principles that you mentioned outlined before about giving treatment, making sure they have an adequate recovery, making sure you have the ability to check levels on a fairly frequent basis. This isn't someone that's going to get one or two doses. They're going to get a fair number of doses. So you want to ensure that you can have those troughs. And one of the challenges that we have is we can't turn around our risdiceatin cofactor assay very quickly. It makes it quite challenging. We can get antigens much quicker. And so I know this is a challenge at certain institutions that can't do this. And that's regardless of their ability to do GP1BM, but I know you're going to talk about the dosing here.
So I think, you know, more and more we definitely are doing surgery in our patients with von Willebrand and definitely major surgeries. You know, this lady underwent the procedure. She got an initial dose, as you can see here, 55 unit per kilo of a recombinant von Willebrand, and you see the levels of von Willebrand factor, the risdiceatin and the factor A levels. You know, since her factor VIII was pretty decent, you know, that's why we made the decision that she could be treated with a recombinant von Willebrand product, and, you know, she did quite well. By day 4 or 5, you know, she was out of the hospital and was receiving 40 units per kilo 3 times a week, at least for 2 weeks or so while she did her physical therapy, had no problem. But again, it comes to the point, how are you going to do that monitoring, right? I think, as Robert alluded, it's very important to be able to, you know, if you can have those levels, because sometimes you'll be surprised, you can get very high levels, especially when sometimes you use a plasma derived, your levels can get quite high, and, you know, you don't want to keep those levels for too long that high. You know, and there are some institutions where they use DVT prophylaxis for those patients, but I think that's when it is important to be able to rely on your laboratory to be able to monitor these patients pretty closely.
So Miguel, I'm curious. This patient clearly has had, you know, joint bleeds, and you could say they're from traumatic bleeding events from competitive sports. But is there a discussion about whether, you know, maybe they should be on prophylaxis indefinitely to sort of limit the long-term damage? You have one knee that's repaired. I'm sure the other one is imperfect.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that discussion happened.
Yeah, she had a lot of traumatic injuries. I mean, this girl was very active. In addition to that, is very heavy as well. So that has been something that has been brought up for discussion, certainly the possibility of doing prophylaxis. She has been kind of reluctant to do it. She might have done it maybe for short periods of time, especially when she was doing, you know, a lot of sports. But I think it's a good point, you know, something that maybe down the road she could definitely benefit if she continues to bleed.
I think having the recombinant product for these sorts of situations is really nice. Just if you have like a patient who's heavy and then their factor VIII to begin with is pretty good, and then they are having a big orthopedic surgery where they're going to be immobile, I feel like it's really nice to not have to worry about that factor VIII going super high and having the opposite problem where they have a thrombosis.
Absolutely.
And I think it's really important to look at the dosing. I mean, oftentimes people just read the guidelines and they suggest a dosing. They don't mention anything about what your levels are. You know, your levels could be, you know, 30 to 50%, or they could be 2%. And so I think oftentimes you see people dosing, giving an appropriate dose in the beginning and then giving very high dosing afterwards, and then they're shocked why their factor VIII level is 400%. And so I think you notice how Miguel, you know, managed that patient and those dosing. He personalized it and dosed it appropriate to what the levels were to hit the target.
Right. I guess the privilege that we are able to get levels every day,
yeah,
on time, so that we usually will make a decision once that result comes out.
Sure.
That, you know, makes it probably a lot easier. I mean, it's something that we already discussed here, but, you know, that surgical risk stratification is important, you know, seeing what kind of procedure that patient's going to have. Is it a major, is it a minor, or something that could be treated with a single dose? So it's always important to be able to plan ahead, right? For this type of patients, make sure you got your multidisciplinary team, both, you know, as an outpatient and in your hospital, and the follow-up for these patients as well. Again, this is something we already discussed, the recommended doses, you know, for surgical procedure, major and minor procedure, as well as dental extractions.
Hopefully you've left here thinking that in patients, persons with von Willebrand's with a history of severe and frequent bleeds, there is expert opinion, there is data, there's community support to consider prophylaxis as a regimen. You know, even, you know, I just thinking about Miguel's patient, this person's obviously had multiple joint bleeds. If that was a hemophilia patient, we would be saying absolutely should be on prophylaxis, but she doesn't have the support probably from her community to say, hey, that's a no-brainer. So I think that's something we have to change. This includes reproductive tract bleeding, and bleeding response should be evaluated and dosing should be adjusted. We want to make sure people are getting the appropriate dose, and just like in hemophilia, we sometimes have to personalize the dosing. Hopefully you understand that heavy menstrual bleeding often requires a multimodal approach, may include the use of VWF replacement,
Typically, often if they're failing other options or if there's a contraindication, and certainly have a number of experiences at our center of lots of type 2A patients that respond very well to different types of products. The diagnostic approach and clinical management is different than hemophilia. Hopefully you leave understanding that. Hopefully I've annoyed you enough for you to understand that. But clinical research investigation really needs to be tailored to the unique characteristics and bleeding patterns of von Willebrand's. Sort of like we talked about in the last DEI session, it's like you'd like to just start over and say, how do we do these trials? How do we get at the answer that we need to get these products approved for prophylaxis? We want a lot of products available for these patients, not just one. And so I think that's really important.